Well, g'day and welcome to another edition of the National Conservative Institute of Australia podcast. My guest today is Poppy Coburn, who is a journalist with the UK Telegraph and has written and worked for a variety of publications, including The Critic, Unheard and GB News. She graduated from the University of Cambridge with a BA Honours in History and Politics, with a particular focus on the work of political philosopher Thomas Hobbes, and was a Publicist Fellow at the Claremont Institute last year. Today we discuss how she describes her politics these days and how it differs from the bipartisan consensus in Westminster, whether there has been any real change within the British Conservative Party since its historic defeat in 2024, why Brexit was misinterpreted, and how the political class across the Anglo-Commonwealth, unlike in America, has not yet done the necessary thinking required to implement a proper nationalist policy agenda, whether she has much hope for the UK in the years ahead, and much, much more. I hope you enjoy our discussion. Oh, Poppy Coburn, welcome to the NatCon Australia podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no sweat. I've been following you online for some time, and I'm sure others that do find you one of the more interesting commentators on conservative politics and the so-called new right. How did you get into conservative politics initially?
I mean, so quite an unconventional route, although I suppose in the UK this is actually quite conventional, insofar as I came from a more kind of radical strand of left-wing politics originally. I would say at university, I was quite heavily involved in environmental protest groups and a lot of the typical youth and rebellion. I had a falling out with some people. I realised I was not on the right track, then switched. And then really ever since graduation, I've been more on a kind of rightward track ever since then. And I'm getting more right-wing by the year.
How would you describe your politics at the moment, though? Because is it something familiar that you could place, in a particular historical school, or is it something new?
I would say I'm predominantly quite nationalist insofar as, and I don't necessarily mean that in the slightly way. I mean that insofar as I think that my politics probably brings a strand between cultural conservatism, or at least some historical sense of itself, and with the economics being not just doctrinal free market dogma. Not to say that I have many friends who are quite open free marketeers, Thatcherites. I think probably what we need in the UK is something a little bit fresher and a little bit newer, particularly on the political side. So I would really predominantly identify with, a British nationalist, I suppose, or patriotic.
Yeah, I mean, you're within a category, and I heard Louise Perry on the podcast that you were on with her describe you as like the Zoomer right, and they're often characterised or contrast with, the baby boomer right. And I never not like, I mean, I appreciate where she keeps coming from, but I never quite like that identity politics, that generational identity politics. But how do you differ, or how would you differ from the bipartisan consensus in Westminster or the normie centre right?
I would say the thing is, generally, I would agree with a lot of people, particularly the more sensible ones in Westminster, about what's gone wrong. I think we all have a similar set of diagnostics as this system isn't working correctly. So a lot of people will critique the system of Westminster governments itself. We will complain about our energy policies. We might be saying about immigration. I think where I would differ is that I'm much more open to taking, I would say, I wouldn't say novel, because I actually think they're quite old-fashioned, but I would use Parliament for what it was originally created to do, which is to act. We have the strongest parliament in the world. Our legislators, if they don't like something, they can change something. I have a lot of disdain for proceduralism. I don't like when people say, slow down, let's wait. I think our crises are quite severe. So I think actually, if you heard me and, to put it, as you say, not quite correctly, a boomer conservative talk about what we disagree with in the UK, we'd probably rattle off the same list of grievances. But where we differ is they might go, oh, well, that's the way things have always been. Let's hope Thatcher comes back, or we get some, charismatic leader who will. And I would say, no, let's not wait. There's things we can do now, even if they make us unpopular and even if they're perhaps a little bit difficult. We need to get going.
But how then, because there is this nostalgia for the 80s and Margaret Thatcher in particular in the UK. How would you differ from those who want a sort of Thatcherite revival?
I think probably on slightly on some of the economics, and I say this like, you know, she was obviously one of our great leaders, but you can make the same argument that Tony Blair was a great leader. I obviously don't agree with a lot of what he did, but he saw some of the broader issues of Britain and actually took that longer term strategy to fix them. I think the problem is our economy is very heavily financialized. We're a services based economy, and that makes us very vulnerable in a world that's closing off. So I think like when the Trump tariff stuff was going, for example, there were a lot of people in the UK who were kind of sitting there and going, this is going to really, really hurt us. We have a very close relationship with America. We obviously have no manufacturing capabilities. We have some of the most expensive industrial energy in Europe. Like, this does not look good for us. And so I think where we kind of differ from the Thatcherites is think there's a degree of complacency of thinking we can continue the same formula that did actually work quite well back then. It really did unlock a lot of economic growth for our country. Yes, there's a lot to be said for deregulation, but that cannot be the end of the story. There has to be a bit of a broader plan about what Britain's place in the world is going to be. That's not necessarily through expanding the state, but it's thinking a bit more strategically.
Yeah, but what do you mean then by being nationalist? Because I'm sure that many of the normie right in the UK would be like the normie right in Canberra. And they would say, look, I'm patriotic, land of hope and glory, salute the flag and all the revel in our history. How does your brand of nationalism differ from what I believe?
I think I'm going to use the example of a British MP who you almost certainly haven't heard of. He's not a celebrity here. He's definitely not a celebrity in Oz. He's a Labour MP. He's a guy called Mike Tapp. And he's been making a bit of a name for himself here in the UK by presenting himself as a patriot. And he's like, don't listen to Farage, don't listen to the plastic populists. You know, I'm a real patriot. I believe in British values. And British values are things like the rule of law. Okay, that seems uncontroversial. I don't know, freedom of expression. Not sure entirely he believes in that, but fine. Basically, uncontroversial platitudes. That sort of thing. Fine, but that's not actually what nationalism is. Nationalism is pursuing the best thing for your country at regardless of cost. That means looking at our energy policy, right? We're one of the earliest adopters of net zero, and going, this has been catastrophic for British industry, catastrophic for British consumers. Yeah, it might upset some of our allies, it might upset some of these international bodies we're a part of, but this isn't working for us. We need to dump this immediately. It's taking something like our defence strategy and going, what are our military capabilities now and what do we want them to be? Do we want to get ourselves involved in European conflicts? Can we avoid getting involved in European conflicts? It's basically saying, like, how can we rebuild a position of strength rather than saying we're going to be the international policeman? Because we can't be the international policeman. We don't have a transfer. it's dumping that internationalism, which is completely fake. You know, there's nothing behind it.
Yeah. And Britain, the impression I get, because it had the empire, it always feels like it has to punch so much more above its weight or still be the air traffic controller of you know, global affairs when they have the capacity to do so. But just to push you a little bit more on that, because I feel like across the Anglo Commonwealth, the centre-right are still in never-Trump land, right? They will agree with everything that George W. Bush would have agreed with, you know, with reservations, but there is still like, you know, liberal interventionist foreign policy, free trade above everything, and mass immigration, but we just need to, you know, integrate them people better. And I feel like that's where the divide exists a bit between the sort of normie right and the new right. Would you go along with that?
I would definitely agree with that. And I think that position has become even more difficult to hold now because particularly, like, look what's happened in Canada, right? So Mark Carney's just been elected. The Liberals were 20 points down 3 months ago. Suddenly he's Prime Minister, you know, it's shocking. And obviously the main reason that people are going to blame that on what Donald Trump has been doing. And to be clear, like, I love the Americans. I love the American people. I think they're fantastic. And I think Donald Trump is a really impressive, you know, kind of world historical figure. But like, yeah, it was not great for him to say he's going to annex Canada. It probably brought the Liberals back into power. So I think, like, if you are now a European conservative saying stuff like, Well, Donald Trump, a lot of his domestic agenda makes complete sense. Like, yeah, you need to bring back manufacturing because you can't like innovate if you don't have manufacturing. You can't like create the technologies of the future if you don't make them at home. Why should we get involved in the Ukraine conflict? It's got nothing to do with our country. Like, why should we? Like, all of those sort of, and of course, the borders stuff, right? Like, how do you fix borders in an age of like international illegal crossings with international law? Well, you smash international law. You say that doesn't apply to our country. Sorry, it doesn't work for us. We're not going to do that. Those lessons are lessons that like we are going to have to learn the hard way. Well, I think there's only probably a hard way, let's be honest. But I think saying it is like, why don't we do what America does is such a difficult sell now. Because people just immediately now can point to you and go, well, hang on, you're not looking out for the interests of Britain, you're looking out for the interests of this foreign country. But we're all like all of the Western nations are kind of coming to a point where there are internal contradictions within the way that we run our states. And we're getting to kind of crunch time now. You know, we don't see economic growth. I mean, Australia is slightly different. You're in a better economic position than we are. But in the UK, like the economy has grown, I think, 4% over the last 5 years. 4%. It's terrible, terrible. Like, and beneath the surface as well, that's not real growth. That's immigration-led growth. So, like, we're not innovating. Like, everyone's standard of living is getting worse. What is your answer to those people? We don't want to be like Trump. Like, seriously? No, is that our answer?
It's very frustrating because he is such a controversial personality, but it's far more, he wouldn't have been successful if it weren't for the policy framework, right? He didn't beat Jeb exclamation mark because he was, you know, more empathetic to reaching out to different groups. He came in with a whole new agenda, and that's why he's been able to get a whole motley bunch of characters to come on board, because it is an intelligible sort of new policy framework, and it just has not sunk in any of the other Anglo capitals today, with some very rare kind of exceptions. They still hark back to the glorious Thatcher Reagan era, which was great in many ways, but is no longer appropriate for its time.
Well, I think also like that, you know, the way that people will like talk about the glorious Thatcher era is not actually reminiscent of what it was like. I think we were to apply, you know, historically accurate contemporaneous Thatcherism to the UK now, that would be just as radical as it was in the 1980s. What people actually mean when they say Thatcherism is anything that I like. So it's putting like a kind of veneer over like kind of wet conservatism.
I agree. Yeah, it's the libertarianish right try to appropriate Reagan and Thatcher and make them all that they were about. But I suspect those guys, you know, Thatcher had a very flinty and a patriotic side to her, right? And so I think she would have looked around today and thought, okay, it's not necessarily free markets which are going to solve all of our ills at the moment.
Also, like, you know, she was a woman of her time, right? Because like the problem in the UK at that moment was the power of the unions. It was a kind of corporatist economy. I went not to go into the weeds of economic history, but like that was the issue facing Britain at the time. And she broke that. And like that, you know, for better or for worse, we're better off for it. Like we could have ended up like Portugal. So fine. Like, but now there are other crises that are really, really severe. And we need someone who will break it. But like in a modern context, like what are the big crises in Britain today? I need someone to come in and do that.
Yeah, you wrote, which I quite liked in an article for The Critic, the news cycles are still dominated with references to events from 40 years ago. The cultural zeitgeist has remained comfortably stuck somewhere between 1981 and 1997. This is no accident. Our journalists, politicians and broadcasters reflect an aging population. The best shot at getting yourself a public platform today comes through reworking the state ideologies of the past while refusing to honestly engage with the material problems of now. That's Australia just as much as the UK, let me tell you.
I think, again, like the Anglosphere has the same problems, but just in different flavors. Like the fundamentals are basically the same everywhere. We're all on a slightly different timeline. But the problems are the same. The problems are the same.
Sometimes you guys move ahead and sometimes you fall behind or do it in different ways. At the moment, it is a little bit interesting on the conservative side in the UK because some of your your leader and your wannabe leaders are saying things that the guys in Australia are not yet saying. For example, you know, Kemi Badenoch coming out with the definitive, you know, groundbreaking statement about what a woman is, which our leaders haven't done here on the conservative side. And then there's Robert Jenrick and others who are, make pretty strong tea statements on immigration, you know, net zero and, you know, mass immigration must end, I think he might have even said. That hasn't been adopted here in Australia. Do you think that there is real, like, deep change in the Conservative Party of Britain afoot?
That's a difficult one, because I think it depends on which faction of the party you're looking at. I would say for the average backbench MP, they have not woken up to the traumatic reality of what happened in 2024, where the party was utterly and totally smashed in a way that, like, really had not happened before in their history for a very, very long time. It was humiliating feat at the hands of Labour. Of course, then the strange thing was that Labour then cratered in popularity, and we've got our local elections coming out, and they're going to do very badly. So you've got the mainstream to be completely delegitimised. And then you also have the kind of Tory fundamentals. Like, what is the party about? Slow incremental change, the strength of institutions. Slow incremental change is really not what we need. We need people to move faster and take place, and our institutions are completely captured. Or utterly incompetent. So they're either malicious or useless. So the party's kind of got a bit of an identity crisis. And then you have someone like Robert Jenrick, who I think probably of the party has done the best job of rebranding himself as this kind of, you know, referring back to Louise Perry, this kind of new right. I'm sure we're on the fifth or fourth concoction of the new right now. He's tried to say things like, act in the national self-interest. Deal with immigration as if it's the biggest political issue facing us today, which I think arguably it is. He's starting to flirt slightly with new economic ideas, although not enough, really. But he's trying to basically draw a line and say, like, almost, yes, I'm part of the party that was behind a lot of the problems that plagued Britain for the last decade, but I'm not really. I'm almost like an insurgent within. You know, I'm your man on the inside. Whereas Kemi Badenoch has been much more, let's party unity. We need party unity. Party unity is a nightmare when half your party is terrible. Half your party believes stuff completely the same. I mean, why would you want unity with those people? It's one of the reasons why the Tories failed, right? So Jenrick's trying to position himself in that way. Whether or not he's going to become leader, whether or not he'll follow through, because, you know, I'm old enough now to have my heart broken by several leaders who will say the sort of things that make me nod and go, like, hey, that's really cool. That's really sound. That's exactly what I think. And then they get in and, oh, well, it's much more complicated. Oh, it's much more complicated, I see. But he is someone to watch. He's definitely interesting. He's definitely an interesting politician.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of having your heart broken, I mean, Brexit sort of was such a sort of traumatic event for people in the UK, which just didn't have the same effect in Australia. We watched it from a distance, blissfully. And it's not, I'm not the first person to say it, but it was just obvious how that event was misinterpreted by the Conservative Party, right? Sort of amateurishly misinterpreted by Boris Johnson and others. They clearly, you know, well, immigration was one, the obvious one, where they thought that this meant ramp up immigration to and that's what a newly independent was about. And they won this dramatic victory, right, where they went, a Trump-style victory, where they went deep into industrial heartland and won Tony Blair's old seat, and then they fumbled it. How did they not get it, or did they not want to get why that they were successful where they were?
I would say I'm going to have to use an American example again. I think it's like Trump term one, where everybody thought it was a fluke, and everyone was like, like in the UK we had quite a conspiratorial turn where everyone was like, well, they won the referendum, but only slightly. The majority of people in the UK don't want radical change. They don't want the thing that they've actually voted for. They're just slightly confused. And so like maybe we don't have to react to it too much. And for the first year after the referendum, it was quite quiet on that front until the kind of pushback came when people realised that, you know, like there were forces within Westminster that were trying to stop the vote, that basically the results of the vote from happening, right? Mm. And that's when it becomes a massive like cultural war battle. And arguably, it tears the Conservative Party apart, right? It really does. I mean, David Cameron obviously resigns. The work, the Europhiles in the party are horrified. They very much move towards the left, or probably more accurately, towards the centre, the hard centre. You have Brexiteers within the party who themselves don't agree on a lot. I mean, even during the campaign trail, there are people saying the reason why Brexit's so great is because we can bring in more migrants from outside of the EU. And that's exactly what happens, right? Exactly what happens. I mean, you can look at charts of immigration from before and after we left the European Union, as people in the UK call it, the Boris wave. And like EU migration is kind of like the slightly trending down, and non-EU migration is like that, straight up.
Yeah.
And I think one of the reasons why it was misinterpreted is because Brexit was like an anti-system, like, I don't like the way things are going. I want more control over my country, and I want immigration to be lower. It's actually a very, very clear message. But people are almost, they were looking so far up their own bottoms, as it were, they're trying to read something else. They're like, it can't possibly be that they want lower immigration. It can't possibly be the case. It must be actually, it must have something to do with manufacturing. Maybe it has to do something that they didn't go to university. Would you like me to build a university in Sunderland? Would you like me to build another university in Sunderland? Would you like me to give you some levelling up money? It's like, no. I want immigration to be lower. Okay, well, we can't do that. And so, like, I mean, I say this is so, I'm glad that we left the European Union. I will never, this is a fantastic thing. We can see this now. I don't want to be part of the EU. It's a dying institution. Fine, whatever. I'm glad we've left. That said, as someone on the right who wants immigration to be extremely low, I cannot defend it on the grounds of how it was used. I don't think we saw the benefits of it, which is, again, where the Trump Term 1 analogy comes in. Trump Term 1 moves around, smashes things. But like he doesn't manage to achieve much because things are too chaotic. He hasn't got allies around him, right? He doesn't achieve what he wants to achieve. Brexit, same thing. Like, it's confused. By the time it actually happens, we're going to crash out the European Union. You know, half the country is like driven into. Loads of people are now like, I don't trust any politicians. They're completely outside of the system altogether. And nobody gets what they want. Nobody gets what they want out of that referendum. Nobody actually gets what they want. And so that anger. It's still there. That anti-system energy is still there, but it's not being funneled anywhere. And you know, Nigel Farage, for all of his redeeming qualities, is probably not going to be the man that gets to really like ride the wave of that anger. Maybe in the short term, but the frustration and the feeling that like you're kind of ringing an alarm and nobody's listening and nobody's doing what you're telling them to do, and you've told them to do for years and years and years and years, is still there. And I think that's what makes Brexit so seminal in British politics. Like 2016 is the moment where like the establishment were kind of asleep, and then they're like shaken awake, and they wanted to go back to sleep again, but that's not going to happen to them.
Yeah, I mean, they seem to have sort of interpreted Brexit as a for patriotism and independence, but then they didn't know what to do with that independence, right. and they thought they didn't understand that people actually wanted a nationalist, at least in my view, program, which stressed, you know, restrictive immigration and a reassessment on trade too. Maybe we'll come to that, because I dealt with China for a long period of time, so I've had a long time to think about trade. And in Britain, because you were part of the EU for a long period of time, you actually never had to deal with international trade policy. It was all part of the big block. After Brexit was finally done, Boris Johnson gave this speech at Greenwich. I'm not sure if you remember that. It was a classic Boris Johnson speech, you know, great little historical allusions and, you know, cute jokes and all the rest of it.
The Churchill Tribute Act.
It's impressive as an act or for an Oxbridge Union type of speech, but I'm getting a little bit kind of sort of, I always now listen to those speeches with a bit of a sort of cynical ear. That's the expression. But anyway, but I don't know. Was there any sort of thinking that maybe that's not what the people who voted for Brexit really wanted, this unilateral, let's bring back the late 19th century Britain, turn Britain into Hong Kong or Singapore on the Thames, like Daniel Hannan or some people were saying. Is that really what they wanted?
I mean, the funny thing about that is that, so I came back from Singapore a couple of weeks ago. I was actually out there. So I got to live Singapore and Thames in real time. And like, sorry, like, even if that's what they said they were offering, if that's what Boris said he was offering, we didn't get that either. Mm. We didn't get deregulation. I mean, this is the funniest thing. And when I said it pleased nobody, it really pleased nobody. Like, okay, I don't necessarily totally subscribe to this ideology, but let's say I did. Okay, if I'm a free trader, I'm like buccaneering Britain on its own, free trade policies, we're going to be shaking hands with leaders all over the world, we're going to be slashing regulations, slashing the size of the state. I don't know happen. We've kept all of the EU regulation. Yeah, I don't have a water bottle in front of me, but you guys don't have this. We have the little cap where you can't. Yeah, that's from the EU.
It was one of those internet things that I didn't quite understand, but sort of realised it was silly. But yeah.
Every time you try and drink a bottle of water in the UK, it like spills down the side of your face because the bottle cap doesn't come off properly, so you recycle it. I mean, it's obviously that's a small grievance, but I think it's indicative of wider attitude where like we kind of crashed out. We didn't actually have any good trade deals lined up. We didn't have much to offer on the international scale. And what you have found, and this is something I'm extremely aggrieved about, is the only thing we can offer the world is visas. So we're in the final stages of a trade deal with India. And this trade deal has been battered about since we left the European Union. And, you know, Modi's India is obviously like could be a big trading partner. It's a very protectionist economy, what they fight for. They don't like us. Modi really does not like the United Kingdom. Says things domestically that make that very clear. He doesn't want to give us a big deal, and they're an economic powerhouse, so they don't have this one. What they do want is more visas for Indian nationals. And so the sticking point in negotiations had been like kind of back and forth. How many visas are we going to give to India? This blew up under the Conservative government because Suella Braverman said in an interview, we don't want to do that. So it blows up. Labour government gets in. All of a sudden, the deal's back on the table. And apparently, they've managed to smooth over some of those edges. So, you know, check the news in a month. You can guarantee Britain gives away tens of thousands of visas to India for a trade deal which removes tariffs on, like, what, I don't know, Scottish wool. It's completely pointless.
Well, this is where Australia is a warning, because we actually did sign a free trade agreement with India. And as part of that, and it was very low profile, there was a labour mobility scheme where there was dual recognition of credentials. That meant, that's what they're after. And so that has resulted in, a surge in immigration from the subcontinent. And Australia, that's a little bit new for Australia, because I know the UK sort of, because of the empire, had much deeper ties and it was just much more familiar with Indian culture in the UK than Australia was, where we were much more kind of focused on China. But that's changed in the last couple of years. Culturally, it has changed in some of the larger cities, in part because of that, in part because of our points-based migration system, which, you know, Boris Johnson also thought they had that was great and had to emulate. So, yeah, this is all these warnings from the future. On trade generally, though, it has been interesting because all, you know, the storied types in the UK have been Dan Hannan, you know, Trump's ridiculous tariffs, Sir Neil Ferguson, Trump's ridiculous tariffs, you know, Will Kingston, the Aussie, now on GB News in the UK. They're all against it. Where do you stand? I mean, where do you?
Okay. I mean, I have defended tariffs before, and I'm going to do so again. I think, again, the way Trump has gone about it, not the way I would have done it. Hubris is the word, right? To start a trade war with like 160 countries is not a good idea. I don't care how rich your country is. That's not smart. Okay. I get what he's trying to do with China. Do I think the time frame is correct? I don't know. But like, I get what he's trying to do that. That said, I understand the desire for certain strategic industries that you need to have tariffs and you cannot rely on inflows of trade. Probably the good example of that is British Steel. So we had a Chinese-owned, our last like domestic steel plant in the UK. Yeah. It's recently, attempted to shut down. It's now been nationalised.
I've been following that.
The government's desperately trying to sell it off again. No one wants to buy it. Main reason it's uncompetitive is because of net zero legislation. We've made it basically impossible to make it even slightly profitable. You can't even break even. I mean, you're losing hundreds of millions of pounds a year making it, right? And now, does it make sense to have tariffs in an industry like that when we're saber-rattling over the war in Ukraine? Yeah, probably. Like, if we can't build anything, we can't build munitions, then that's probably an industry we would like to selectively have tariffs on. I agree that, like, the UK, you know, we're never going to have a big manufacturing base again. It's just geopolitically not possible. Like, we're too small a country. We've de-skilled over too long a time. There are industries that we could do very well in. It's probably more high-tech stuff. Fine. But there, it's so common sense that when it's the Labour government saying something like, we believe in the doctrine of free trade, I'm like, listen to yourselves. Like, what do you actually mean by that? What do you mean by that? Because it seems to me here, that's not working. and, you know, it was the Labour government that was reluctant to engage in nationalisation as a strategic industry. It's like the two things, like there's complete cognitive dissonance. We need to get ready for war. We are going to go to war with Putin's Russia. We're going to put like 10,000 troops down. Okay, well, probably not possible, but we're saying that, fine. At the same time, we have no domestic capability of building munitions. We get them all from the US. Oh, and also the US is no longer an ally to the UK, and we hate Trump. And we need to, I don't know, put some kind of sanction on this government. All of those things cannot all be true. You cannot hold all of those thoughts in your head at the same time. Although apparently the UK government is, right? So that's where you get the inertia. You get the lack of movement because everything is inconsistent. Nothing really makes sense. There's no strategy.
I just find some of these, you know, big thinkers, that they talk in the language of abstractions. You know, free, and they'll quote Adam Smith to you, chapter and verse, they'll quote, you know, David Ricardo. And then you ask them, well, I mean, we recently had the last glass manufacturer in Australia producing window stuff for houses. And I bet if you ask any single person, well, who's their direct competitor? Where are they located and how do they produce that? They would have no idea. They'd just be like, well, you know, it makes sense in this, you know, ideal world that we've constructed in their head. And they just don't understand at some level, you know, a nation needs a base industrial capacity to produce things that it might need for military purposes, or it might need sort of to have productive men engaged in, you know, useful, decent work, right?
If you think the peace dividend is over, like if you actually think that the age of peace is over, like the post-Cold War consensus where the US is the global peace dividend, and we all get rich through globalization, that's dead.
Yeah.
Then you need to respond to that. Like, you can disagree that that is the case. You can say, no, I still think the US is the hegemon. I think this is like a temporary kind of step back from Trump, and maybe we're going to go back to the status quo. Fine. Like, you can believe that. That at least kind of makes sense. But you cannot say, like, the world is about to go to war over, like, Taiwan. Mm. And also, at the same time, we shouldn't be building munitions. That doesn't make any sense. And that's the really frustrating.
We have a similar incoherency here where we'll throw a lot of public funds at trying to boot up a strategic industry, but we will have, you know, the agreement we have with China allows 100% of manufactured goods from that country to come in duty-free. So at some point, you know, you bump up against, I mean, J.D. Vance had that great line, the worst possible foreign policy for a country to adopt is to go to war with China and for China to make all your stuff. I mean, that does not make sense. And yet that is the sort of attitude. There's very butchy talk in Western capitals about China being, you know, Neil Ferguson, I'm sure he'll give you some stirring speech about the axis of ill will or God knows what. But, we've got to outsource it all to produce that in Shenzhen. Sorry, mate, that doesn't fly.
No. And I think as well, like, you shouldn't listen to neocons who are trying to keep quiet their neocon past and actually now present themselves as cultural vanguard or whatever. I mean, I think you could make a really convincing argument that, like, the UK cannot pull away from the US, at least in the short to medium term. It's just not physically possible. Our economies are too deeply intertwined. Our defence is literally dependent on the US being a friend to us. Like, our nuclear deterrent is dependent on US replacement parts. Like, Trident does not work without the US. So, like, you don't get a closer relationship than that. And if the US is moving away from China, then, like, there's going to have to be some degree of consistency. Otherwise, they're going to slap nasty tariffs on us. We know that. We do know that. I think it's just them thinking, like, where is our role in the longer-term future? Like, where do we actually want to see ourselves? Because to me, it seems like we should be trying to, like, hold on to all of the anchor spheres as tightly as possible as, like, reliable allies, rather than keep going back to Europe, which is, like, we're a basket case, but they're on fire at this point. Like, they're in a really difficult situation. Obviously, we're going to have a lot in common. There's a lot of trade between the UK and Europe. I'm not denying that. But, like, in terms of, like, a long-term strategy of where we can pull our advantages, it's got to come from the anchor sphere. And America is going to be a part of that, for better or worse. And if that means we change our position on China, that means we change our position on China. And if we're going to be trading between the anchor sphere, that's fine. But then we need to have that in writing. We need to have that, like, as a clear strategic goal that we're aiming towards. Because what we can't have is, say, China, you can't build a big super embassy in London. Also have Rachel Reeves, our chancellor, flying over to Beijing and going, please, can I have a trade deal? Please, please, please. Like, that doesn't make sense. You can't do it both at the same time. You know, they're not stupid. They're not smarter than we are. You know.
Where do you, part of the problem, at least one analysis of all this, is that these are all byproducts and problems with liberalism, the governing ideology of this sort of age. Open borders, open trade, neoconservative foreign policy. So if someone who believes in freedom of speech in Kyiv says so, they are akin to us, the same. We're bound together by values or these liberal axioms. Where do you stand on that? Because I think you wrote an article where you were totally on board with the post-liberal label, but you're nevertheless sort of critical of, you're on the same page with many of those things.
I think I'm slightly ambivalent about the post-liberal label sometimes, because I think sometimes it's used as, like, a shield for people that have cultural politics but no economic politics, which is, like, kind of pretty fundamental. So you can say, like, we're going to take control of the universities, but, like, where's the money going to come from? Whatever. When you say stuff like values that are liberal, the thing about the UK is that we don't really have liberal values. What we have is, like, the colony come home. We have a state that is broadly being delegitimized, that knows it's quite deeply unpopular with people, and is reactionary with a capital R, in that, like, it increasingly fears, like, the polis, to the extent to which it's constantly commissioning, like, think pieces, like, having conversations with the police about the threat of more riots, civil disobedience. It's, like, trawling through social media, for examples of, like, dissent. It's swivel-eyed, it's paranoid. It does not believe in values of free association or free speech. I mean, literally, in law, we do not have free speech or free association, and we haven't for, like, decades now. I would rather live in a liberal Britain, like a classically liberal Britain, than the Britain that we have today. I don't think you can say it's liberal. I think you can say it's libertine in some ways, but it's always kind of contradicted with a kind of crushing authoritarian impulse. So perhaps like a good example of this is, like, as I said, the social media crackdown. We have constant propagandizing over the real threat the UK's online safety. Online safety, we're obsessed with this. People are too mean to MPs. Like, you'd be shocked how much news coverage revolves around mean tweets being sent to, like, Jess Phillips, the Labour MP. There is no understanding, like, the anger on the ground of how frustrated people are. Partly because I think politicians don't know how to respond to it, and they're frightened. They're genuinely quite frightened of people now. There's a feeling that, like, the mainstream, the centre is cracked apart and maybe won't be coming back. Then, as you pointed out, the Ukraine stuff. I mean, the Ukraine stuff is really fascinating, and I'm not going to defend Russia, but they're indefensible. Obviously, the UK has a role to play in defending Ukraine. They've fought extremely valiantly, etc. We've made promises to them. Maybe we shouldn't have made those promises because clearly we can't follow them through. That's by the by. As you correctly pointed out, saying stuff, trying to apply, like, kind of imperial notion of, like, we can be the policemen of Europe when we don't have defence capacity, and when, like, we don't believe in those values for our own people. It's just insane. And that's what JD Vance was getting at, right, at the Munich Security Conference speech. And I understand why Europeans are angry having an American come over and kind of waggle a finger, you know, took it off Stuart. Like, you guys have been meddling in our politics for a while. But he was completely right. Like, he was like, you guys are weeping over liberal democracy. But like, you don't believe in liberal democracy in the same way we kind of don't. You guys are just as guilty as us. You overturn elections and you don't like the result. You try and ban political parties when you think they're too frightening. Like, your response to whatever you want to call it, the populist wave, what it actually is people being correctly angry that their material conditions are getting worse and nobody seems to be doing anything to fix it. It's not populism, that's reality. Is to ban things and to run away from democracy and say you don't believe in it anymore. I'm sorry, I'm not taking lessons in morality from you people. How are you any better than MAGA? How are you any better than MAGA? At least MAGA's got a vision of what they're trying to do at the end of it. I'm not going to say that MAGA has a load of respect for the rule of law. It clearly doesn't. Neither do we. Neither do we.
Yeah. No, it's crazy. I mean, J.D. Vance ticked them off, not just because he said something critical, but because he had a point. It's always annoying when people tell you something which has a grain of truth through it, because you can fob off stuff which isn't true. But you know, I could see why they're annoyed. Just to go into a little bit more on this post-liberal stuff, because you guys under David Cameron had a lot of, you know, I had Philip Blonde on the podcast, but there was a lot of sort of rethinking the right at that stage with the big society and this sort of woolly communitarianism where you establish these new, you know, civil associations of platoons and all the rest of it. We didn't have any of that in Australia during the time. The political cycle was one thing, but it just never really kind of caught on. How did that work out?
I would say, and this is going to be controversial to post-liberals, I think they got a lot of what they wanted, but the outcomes weren't exactly what they expected, so they pretended that they didn't get what they asked for. Insofar as, like, the UK is a pretty communitarian society. We spend a lot of money, much more than Australia, on the social welfare system. We've had a massive debate over PIP, disability payments, which we've shot up after the pandemic. I mean, the pandemic's the best example, right? We shut our country down to protect the border community. We've been constantly, like messages of, like, Paddington Bear and this guy called Captain Tom.
That's terrible.
Totally throwing sentimentality. And at the front of it, the word community. Every politician uses that word in every single speech from the mainstream. I mean, they've been using it since I was born. And so I think sometimes, yes, you can say those informal little platoon systems, I would like them to come back. But you don't get community without free association. You don't get community without people being allowed to, like, form groups on their own. When it's the government itself kind of coming down and saying, like, I'm instituting, like, a false group of people who are going to sit around and talk about how much they loved modern Britain and its values, like, that's not community. But I think they don't realise that, like, the reason why the UK had these, like, ancient bonds that were formed between people, had such a strong civil society, is because it also had political liberty and it had freedom. And those two things do actually go hand in hand. And it also and also prosperity. Prosperity creates the conditions for civil society in the same way that I think philosophy in ancient Greece is created by, like, improvements in agriculture, which allows people to sit around thinking all day. It helps if you have a world-spanning empire. If you want to join the Village Green Preservation Society, because things are generally ticking on okay. And so my view is you've got to look at the big picture stuff first. You've got to fix the fundamentals first. You've probably got to be a bit mean first as well. And you've got to be honest about your fellow citizens rather than having quite a woolly, friendly, rose-tinted vision of what Britain is. Because I'm sorry, I think that is the road to madness. Like, that is just politicians picking it up and going, that sounds easy, I'm just going to do that again, rather than having to pick up the stuff that's nasty and hard, which they don't want to do. You're really going to have to push them to do that.
Yeah, it all sounded so sort of, I don't know, lovely, this, you know, rejuvenation of civil society in England. And I remember, I might have even used just a comment on the Telegraph, but there was some mum who wrote in saying, you know, where am I going to find the time to establish the, I don't know, the Surrey Knitting Society or this, that, and the other, because I've got this, that crushing taxes, this. And it was just, I mean, it was just seemed very divorced from the real, the day-to-day life of people who are, you know, crushed between family and work and everything.
If you want the public sphere to be beautiful and clean and pleasant, then, like, I don't know, here's my, like, rebuttal to post liberalism. Why are you guys not talking about immigration all the time? Why is that not your number one issue? Social cohesion.
Yeah.
Like, how are you going to have community when society is more divided than ever?
Yeah.
Like, that does not work. So if you really want to bring the conditions back for communitarianism in Britain, like, that's one thing you could actually, like, advocate for that has a material basis that makes sense for politicians to listen to. I would love all of the UK to look like Oxford and Cambridge. They're very beautiful cities. But they don't. They really, really don't look like that. Particularly when you leave London, you will see that there is a great deal of poverty, despair. There is a lot of illness. There is, you know, like obesity, all of these social ills that you cannot fix by talking about re-enchanting. Like, I'm sorry, that's just not how things work. We've got to be a little bit more.
There is such a tendency of academics or even opinion piece writers to get a bit sort of high on their own supply, the way they can turn words and suddenly what they write magically becomes reality, even though it's very divorced from what is truly out there. Just you did a lot of work on the investigating the NGO sector, which again is, you know, so that probably what did you find? It probably has created a bit of cynicism in the virtue of these new found little platoons that have been established.
So it's really funny. It's like all of these Victorian philanthropy organizations turned out to be run by like insane communists. Really weird discovery I made. I mean, and by the way, I'm not using communists in just like a kind of Red Scare script line way. I mean, like actual self-identified communists. So like Joseph Rantry Foundation, the Esbury Fanbeam Foundation, Barrow Cadbury Foundation. A lot of them were Quaker chocolatiers, so they all have quite whimsical names. These are massive funding bodies with like combined billions of pounds worth of assets that basically fund the entire progressive movement in the UK. And this is how I found out about them. So I started to look into charity groups or groups that had charitable status who were pushing back against the Rwanda plan, which is ancient history, but it was
a deportation plan.
And I looked through the filings on because if you're a charity, registered charity, you had to declare where all your money is coming from. And I looked through all of them and same kind of names trust coming up and up and up and up. I was like, that's really weird. Why is like the Tolkien Trust, you know, which was set up in by Tolkien's son, and I would imagine it's quite socially conservative, running a group that's called like End Borders Now. and so I kind of looked into the history of how the law had changed and how this kind of quiet political activism, this really dark money is slushing around and creating these quite astroturf forces that then look like they've got a load of populist support because they've got some money. And I was like, oh, wow, like a lot of left-wing thought in the UK is being funded by these trusts. That's the reality of civil society, by the way. If you want to empower the charity sector, by the way, this is what David Cameron did in the 2010s. He was a big society man. He said, like, let's shrink the state. He didn't manage to do that, but he said he would. Let's shrink the state and give the power to the charities. And the charities were like, great, okay. So let's end the criminalization of homelessness so we can build tent cities in London. Let's like advocate against border controls. Like a laundry list of like kind of far left grievances, right? This is not an old lady outside of a supermarket jangling a collection pot for donkeys. That is not the reality of charity in the UK. And so I think it was another kind of revealing moment for me that, like, we cannot delude ourselves about the material conditions of, like, how society works. And this is true of all the Anglos. I know Australia has the exact same situation. America has the exact same situation. Like, there's a lot of money sloshing around from billionaires who died a long time ago that's been basically captured by a small group of quite determined activists who are then like flowing it towards the causes they believe to essentially circumvent democratic process. And like, we need an answer to that. We need a way of dealing with that. Because if not, like, we can all sit around and agree that our ideas are correct. But if you don't have money, if you don't have foot soldiers, you're not going to win.
I'm quite familiar with this in Australia because one of my mates, a former Labor MP actually, Gary Johns, he wrote a book called The Charity Ball, which exposed a lot of the shenanigans in the charity sector in Australia. And then, to their credit, the last centre-right government here actually appointed him as head of the charity regulator.
Oh, wow.
So he was able to sort of tighten, but it's very hard to completely tighten all the loopholes because they wiggle in very different ways. But there was additional transparency provided to it. So we might be a little bit ahead of the UK in that respect. I'm just curious, though, why do you think, how can the charity sector, which, you know, in theory at least is necessary and should do all sorts of good work, how can it be reclaimed for the right or for the right causes and the political right?
So I thought about this. There are things you can do in the tightening of the law, in the way that you word legislation about who gets to be a charity.
Yeah.
I think you can even have like a smaller number of charities. And I don't know. So like if 50% of your income as a charity comes from a trust, you get shut down because that's not coming from small donations. That's potentially going to be used for political causes. You could just have a blanket ban on that. Fine. What you cannot do, and this is, again, the folly of the right, we've made this mistake many times, is to think that you can change things from the inside. The system is stacked against you in a very fundamental way, and that you do not have enough people who are willing to like turn up at meetings and make that their whole life. We don't have those sorts of people. What we do have is we win elections. The majority of people instinctively share our values. So we have the power of the state kind of behind us. We have, you know, in the UK, we have Parliament behind us that can intervene in anything it wants to. Anything. We don't have a constitution. We can do anything we want.
I know. You're amazing. It's amazing compared to Australia.
We never use it. we never use it, so it's pointless. So, you know, in theory. And you know, what you should not do, though, is think, if I just put five of my guys in a room full of 1,000 people who are entirely hostile to them, and they know who they are, and they know what they're doing, they will undermine you, they will subvert what you're trying to do, they will chew you up, and they will spit you out. It is a waste of time. We have to learn that is not the way to go about it. If you want to get rid of something, ban it. Ban it. If that's what you want to do, they do it to us all the time. When they get in government, do you think they sit there going, oh, I'm not sure if this is the right thing to do? No, they go, don't like it, let's ban it. Get rid of it. Don't like it.
That's the core problem across the political scene on the right. We kind of, the liberal right thinks that the ideal is for them to be set up a system where they're the perfect umpire and the rules are clear and then everyone just plays their own game, rather than, you know, the more conservative approach, which is to say we want to create a society in a particular way, which is true to, you know, what our ancestors have and hopefully will be passed on to our future generations. But that's not how liberals think. They don't really care what the future looks like as long as it's, in theory, accords with these, you know, abstract liberal axioms. And I think that's a big divide, at least in my view.
There's a progressive book that was written, I think, in the 60s or the 70s in America. It's very much not well known. It just shows how much of a how hardcore I am about this stuff. And it's called Liberation is an Endless Meeting. And it's about community organizing and the power of community organizing. And I know that makes you want to fall asleep. It makes me want to fall asleep. I don't want to sit in an endless meeting. But they do. They'll do it. So if we can't beat them at that, then we have to think to a little alternative strategy. What we cannot delude ourselves is thinking that marketplace of ideas is real. Because it's not. It's really not. The best ideas do not win out. You can win elections, but that doesn't mean the stuff that you believe in is going to get instituted, which I think the British people are realizing now. You know, we've won a lot of elections on the basis of a relatively right-wing agenda, and it hasn't been instituted because you don't actually have those informal mechanisms of the state that make that policy. And until you have some of those people, or until you've at least got an eye like pointed at every single one of those groups and being like, I'm watching you, like you're going to do what people voted for, or you're going to get shut down. You're never going to get what you want. You're never going to achieve the things you want to achieve because there are these kind of forces that you can't control. we just don't have that many people. We don't have that many.
Yeah. Or you win a great election like Boris Johnson did, and then you decide you're going to ramp up immigration, go full balls to the wall on net zero and sign a free trade agreement with India, or God knows, you know, it just doesn't seem anything like what the voters actually would have wanted. Hey, paint an I always, when these discussions often get a bit doom and gloomy, paint a wildly optimistic picture for the UK over the next five to 10 years, probably.
I mean, I'm extremely optimistic. I still get up in the morning every day. The great thing about the UK is that our problems, although they are various, are entirely fixable. Like they are actually fixable. In terms of human capital, I think we've got some of the best people in the world, you know, and we've got so much talent and we've got so much energy. We've made a lot of really big mistakes after the past has. But there is still a way out of this problem, but it requires us acting now. And so there's a challenger party reform that's coming through. I'm not naive. I think if they are not pushed by the right people into taking a certain policy platform, they will fail. If they don't know what they're up against, they will fail. I don't want a protest party. We've had that. It's failed. Mm-hmm. But there are opportunities. We've got our next general election in 2029. That seems like a long time away, but it's not. It will come quicker than we think. If we can just have a plan this time, we can just go into it with eyes open and be like, let's not repeat the same mistakes over and over and over again, because we may not have another chance. Things may actually get really bad after then. A lot's achievable. You know, you're not going to get everything you want at once, but building that foundation, you can still do. I think more and more people now are coming around to, well, my way of ideas, not that I came up with them, but the same sort of radical action is needed, right? People are starting to get fed up. And so they will listen more to people who say, let's take this course of action that 5 years ago, 2 years ago, would have been utterly beyond the pale. And so that gives me a lot of hope.
Yeah, I think the good thing about the UK, it is bigger, it has a longer cultural tradition. I also feel like there's, and maybe it's because London is just so big, we're a bit more spread out in Australia, but there are, you know, interesting writers and thinkers who do make a name for themselves internationally. I sometimes cynically think it's because the Americans like to hear a British accent say them rather than an Australian one, which explains Rory Stewart, you know, why he does tours of Australia rather than...
I'm so sorry.
It's a problem for us all. But that does give me hope, and at least, and hopefully it's not, you know, the flowering of great thinkers after a civilization has sort of been, on the way down. I sometimes think that. Yeah. Hey, Poppy, great to chat to you. If people want to find you and your work, and where do they go?
So I write in The Telegraph, which is our big conservative paper here in the UK. So I write quite regularly there. I do a newsletter in US politics as well, if you're interested in a Brit take on a former colony. You can also find me at Twitter at Kafka's Wife.
Awesome, mate. Well, great to chat, and look forward to keeping up with you in the future.
Thanks for having me.
See ya. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.